We saw record high turnout among Asian American voters in 2018 for a midterm election, and we are likely to see that again in 2020 for a presidential election.
An expert says that can be partially attributed to the new Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's Friday, August 14th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, one White House official says Chinese hackers were targeting U.S. election infrastructure. One who investigates the coronavirus says most people who have or had the disease have been uncounted. It is all on today's VOA Asia. Kamala Harris has become not only the first black woman on a major party's presidential ticket in the United States, she also became the first Indian American, South Asian, and Asian American person to be chosen. We welcome to VOA Asia Karthik Ramakrishnan, a professor of political science at the University of California, Riverside, and the director of the National Asian American Survey. Professor, thanks for being with us. What was your initial reaction to Joe Biden's choice of Senator Harris as his running mate?
You know, it's interesting because in some ways people characterize it as a safe choice, but in many ways it is historic and groundbreaking, right? So you have, it's the first black woman nominated for vice president, the first Indian American, Asian American, South Asian American, however you want to characterize it, nominated for vice president.
How large is the Indian American community?
The Indian American population, there are two different ways that they measure it in the United States. One is if you look at people who just check off Indian, and those who say they're Indian and something else. So Kamala Harris would be someone who would fit that category. So if you look at the just Indian alone, it's about 4.2 million in 2018. That's the latest data that we have. And if you look at the combination, it's 4.5 million. To put that into context, that's about as large as the Chinese American population, which is the largest Asian American group. And it's grown tremendously. So since 2000, the Indian American population has grown by 150%. So that is remarkable growth. It has more than doubled within two decades.
How much support does President Trump hold in the Indian American community? I was in Houston the day before Trump and the Indian prime minister drew tens of thousands of people to Reliance Stadium for a rally.
President Trump certainly has tried to make inroads in the Indian American community. He has a very close relationship with Prime Minister Modi. But at the same time, it was always going to be a bit of a challenge. Indian Americans traditionally, since we've been collecting data in 2008, have been very strong Democratic voters, and that doesn't change easily. On top of that, there have been many policies ranging from immigration to healthcare, and even the rhetoric of the president on issues related to race that has turned off a lot of Indian American voters. So it was going to be challenging to begin with. I think with Harris's appointment, that challenge became even steeper. And especially in states like Texas, Florida, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Michigan, these are all states with significant Indian American voters that could tip the balance towards the Democratic candidate.
It does appear that U.S. foreign policy is heavily swung toward India under Trump. Could that bring more Indian American votes to Donald Trump in November?
Yes. So, you know, what's interesting is that I think there's a lot more attention to this in India and also among more recently arrived immigrants or those who pay a lot of attention to U.S. foreign policy. Our surveys have shown throughout the years that U.S. foreign policy plays a very small role in the decision-making of Indian American voters. I think if you look at a diverse country like America, you absolutely are going to have diversity of opinion in terms of particular issues, especially those involving foreign relations. My sense is that that Joe Biden and his team are responding to some of that criticism. And I've heard that there's going to be an event involving the Indian American community on Indian Independence Day, August 15th, that I think addresses some of those issues and concerns.
You do seem to be saying there's a greater Indian American voter support for the Democrats than for the incumbent Donald Trump. Why do you say that?
You know, I think it's important for listeners, especially in Asia, to understand that even though the vast majority of Asian American voters are naturalized citizens, meaning they're first generation immigrants, and even though they might retain their ties to the homeland, most of the issues that concern them are domestic issues. And those issues have tended to be the economy and jobs, and that's a major issue this year. The pandemic is likely going to be a major issue among Asian American voters. We're in the field with a survey right now. But then healthcare and education, these are also important issues. And on all of those issues, Democrats have tended to have an advantage, but we will see. It'll be an exciting time in 2020 because we saw record high turnout among Asian American voters in 2018 for a midterm election, and we are likely to see that again in 2020 for a presidential election.
Karthik Ramakrishnan, a professor of political science at the University of California, Riverside, and the director of the National Asian American Survey. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. Experts warn that a snap decision by the Malaysian government to limit migrant workers to just a few industries could backfire. Thailand's king swears in six new cabinet officials amid unprecedented student-led protests denouncing the monarchy. China pushes for the adoption of a new worldwide internet protocol that could make the internet bigger and faster, but also potentially less anonymous. Three people in southern India are dead after violence erupted between police and protesters over a Facebook post about the Prophet Muhammad. An Afghanistan official says formal peace negotiations with the Taliban will begin in Qatar early next week. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien said this past weekend that Chinese hackers were targeting U.S. election infrastructure in the lead-up to the November 3rd presidential election, making a new claim about the level of Beijing's activity in the election. With the U.S. political conventions about to get underway, VOA Mandarin Service reporter Adriana Zhang spoke with Edward Perez, the Global Director of Technology Development at OSET Institute, a nonprofit election technology organization, on the possibility of cyber breaches and disinformation from China on the elections.
In 2020, I think that the United States should definitely be considering China as one of several nation-state actors that could potentially be wanting to interfere in our presidential election. Whether it's China, whether it's Russia, Iran, North Korea, there's no doubt that a lot of foreign countries are attempting to exert influence in terms of their global power, in terms of their policy, by trying to influence the U.S. presidential election. It was definitely a watershed in 2016 when the U.S. intelligence community found that that Russia was responsible for such meddling. And I think it is safe to assume that not only since 2016 are other countries going to stand down or do less, but if anything, we probably need to be even more prepared. And yes, I would include China again, along with several other countries. And I think it's important to maintain perspective. Many do believe that the most formidable threat is not China, but is Russia. But that is not a reason to protect ourselves on multiple fronts.
So which one do you think is more damaging to the U.S. election and the democracy? Is the hacking behavior or the disinformation?
I think that the damage that can be done by disinformation should not be underestimated. And the reason for that is, generally speaking, it is easier to wage a disinformation campaign and to create doubt, to undermine the credibility of the elections. It is easier to do that sort of a campaign with something as straightforward as social media, careful placement of false or partially false information with the media. There are so many ways to influence people's opinion through the media and through social media with disinformation that it's generally an easier kind of attack to wage than actually getting into very sensitive cybersecurity systems. I think that even within the U.S., the cybersecurity, infrastructure security agency, for example, that works within the Department of Homeland Security. On the one hand, they express a great degree of confidence in the extra protection that they have been able to give cybersecurity systems, especially as compared to 2016. They do think that there's more attention, more awareness, and more resources available. Given all of that, I think it's especially telling when that same federal agency that is trying to protect elections has really been very consistent in their own concern about disinformation and the challenges that it faces. There is absolutely no doubt that it will be a very important factor in the November elections. It's already happening now. It's probably safe to assume that those efforts will be ramped up before then. And the United States, again, as a matter of national security, really be thinking about those sorts of threats, both domestic and from foreign actors.
VOA Mandarin Service reporter Adriana Zhang speaking with Edward Perez, Global Director of Technology Development at the OSET Institute. In late March, COVID-19 survivor Deanna Berendt found a grassroots movement called Survivor Corps with a two-part mission. First, it would mobilize COVID-19 survivors to donate their antibody-rich plasma to those who were infected. And second, Survivor Corps volunteers would participate in scientific research to better understand and develop treatments. 5 months and millions of infections later, doctors now deal with the debilitating long-term symptoms the novel coronavirus can cause in those who are no longer contagious. VOA's Adam Phillips asked Berendt for an update, both on the lessons learned and the gaps that remain.
We have learned so much since last we spoke. When we spoke last, we thought it was a respiratory disease. We now understand it's a clotting disease, which is why it's affecting the brain and the heart and the kidneys and all of the other organs. And we thought that it only affected the elderly and the immunocompromised, but we are all extremely vulnerable to this disease. There's nobody who is safe from it. And we now know it's airborne. That changes things dramatically.
What else have you learned?
That COVID is having a long-term impact on people's bodies and on children's bodies as well. However, the vast majority of people who are infected with COVID, and we are now at over 5 million infections in the United States, are being actively told to not seek any medical help whatsoever unless they cannot breathe, in which case they are to go to the emergency room. So the vast majority of people infected with COVID are not being tracked by the medical community. Their experiences have gone basically unrecorded, and they are suffering 5-6 months into the virus with debilitating symptoms. And we are also actually launching Recovery Corps, which will be a longitudinal study done in coordination with Columbia University. It will track COVID patients over years, tracking their antibody levels and tracking them symptomatically to see how their symptoms evolve and hopefully resolve over time. But unfortunately, we are going to need to have post-COVID care centers throughout the country.
Deanna Berendt is the founder of Survivor Corps, connecting COVID-19 survivors with the medical, scientific, and research communities. Thank you for being with us on VOA Asia. Hong Kong's Commerce Secretary Thursday rejected U.S. plans to order goods imported from the territory to carry a Made in China marking from September. Speaking after meeting representatives of local trade chambers, Edward Yao said the rule was a deliberate attempt to sort of undermine Hong Kong's custom territory, which was separate from mainland China.
Our reaction to the U.S. recent attempt to impose a origin marking requirement on Hong Kong product, basically asking Hong Kong traders to tell a lie that, well, product made in Hong Kong would be misdescribed as made in China.
A Hong Kong government statement this week also strongly objected to the U.S. plans, which were published on the U.S. Federal Register by the Customs and Border Protection. Thank you for being with us today. Thanks to our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, which includes Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Please stay safe and enjoy the day ahead.